Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming, and thank you so much for supporting public radio where you listen to it. Now, with the Righteous Brothers and Gary Puckett and the Union Gap coming to San Bernardino soon, later this evening it's Music and Conversation with Gary Puckett. More on the concert at affordablemusicproductions.com. First, though, we go to the ballet. Lillian Vasquez has more.
My guest is Jonathan Sharp. He's the director and choreographer for an upcoming production of Inland Pacific Ballet's Cinderella. It'll take place on April 28th and 29th at the Fox Performing Arts Center in Riverside. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Before we start talking about Cinderella, will you share a little of your background and when you knew you wanted to dance?
You know, I think performance came for me first. I started actually performing in church. My grandfather was a minister, and so I would go to church with him. And I think for me, that sense of church and performance in church is the connection to the soul and spirit that I find as a performer myself. So I started really singing, and singing actually and dancing are, you know, a match made in heaven. So then I started dancing, and I had physical talent for dance, and then I was sort of pushed in that direction, and then I ended up at the New York City Ballet School. But in my performance career, I've done classical ballet with major ballet companies and also Broadway.
And what do you prefer? Are you enjoying what you're doing now, or?
You know, I probably enjoy most the switch. So I always keep a very full schedule, and I think becoming a director and now stepping out of just being a performer is also thrilling. I find now, I said to someone yesterday, I said, you know, now I dance through other dancers as a choreographer. So I still find myself as a dancer in those performers that I'm coaching and working with. And what's even more thrilling to me is when they surpass even what I had as a dancer. So that's just really satisfying as a creator.
And now that you're on that side of it, as opposed to being the dancer and doing the instructions, do you see where your instructors were coming from? Do you take it the same way they did? Did you go a different route as you teach these young individuals about this talent?
You know, I probably didn't in my performance career equate how valuable they were as an outside eye. Because when you're in the middle of something and you're trying to live as a character and also, you know, follow the steps and the music and, you know, if you're acting and the dialogue, all of those things, you know, you're focused on having to do tasks, but you want to liberate it, and you do need an outside eye to tell you how it reads, you know, because you may think, oh, I landed it, and then they say, oh, well, it didn't really read, and it may not read because you're emoting and acting, but the, like, basket you're holding is too high up and we can't see your face, you know what I mean?
right, yeah,
so,
sure.
You know what I mean? So everything, there's a synergy to all of it, and I'm finding a depth of artistry from the other side.
Now, tell me, how did you land at Inland Pacific Ballet? You're also an instructor at Idlewild Arts, are you not?
Yes, I am. I teach at Idlewild Arts full-time. I'm the director of artistic outreach on campus as well.
So how did you land at Inland Pacific Ballet?
You know, I guest performed with them, I think in their second season, at Bridges Auditorium in the Nutcracker with Leslie Brown, who's a very famous ballerina, Academy Award nominee. And she and I guested all over the world together, and we ended up doing Nutcracker with ITV. And then years later, I moved to LA because I'd been on a television show, and I wanted to look into television, you know, just like what that career was. So I moved to LA, and I was contacted by Vicky to see if I was available to do Dracula in their original production of Dracula. Hmm. And I did, and I really liked the professional environment. I loved the emphasis on training, and I also thought that the environment there was very positive and very supportive, and so I continued to work there. Then I became more of a teacher in the school, and then I became a teacher for the company, and then in the last version of Cinderella that we did, I re-choreographed the last scene where she actually gets to put the shoe on, but I was like, you know, if you've ever seen the foot of a ballerina, you know, it's taped, blistered, and I was like, you know, she doesn't need to take her shoe off. What if she just had the other shoe as a gift from the fairy godmother and she just produced the other shoe? So that was my first sort of foray into working artistically with the company and directing a scene. And then from there, Vicky asked me to come on as associate director, and I sort of reworked the production of Nutcracker a bit, and now Cinderella.
me about the Ilan Pacific Ballet. How long has it been around, and when did it get its start? Do you know?
Ilan Pacific Ballet has been around for 23 years. Could be 24. We're headed towards our 25th year anniversary in, I think, a year and a half. You know, it started with a mission to offer professional engagement to talented dancers in the area, the broader Los Angeles area and the Inland Empire. And Vicky really created that. And for 23 years, she's been able to maintain that. The company has an incredible school, and a lot of the dancers who dance professionally with us have come up through the school and gone off to be professionals and come back. And so it's really just this great little jewel of a high-class classical organization in a place I don't think you'd really expect it. It's not that it's unexpected, but it, you know, you wouldn't think, oh, Montclair has this incredible ballet.
Let's talk about Cinderella. I'm assuming there's a fairy godmother, some stepsisters, and of course a lovely Cinderella are involved. Tell me about what our audience would see if they were able to attend.
Well, one of the things that I found really fantastic, we do lecture demos with kids, and one of the things that they love to watch is the scenes change. So I've put three fairy godmother transformations in the show where the sets move around while the fairy godmother is wielding her wand. And what little girl out there doesn't want to see the fairy godmother wield her wand and make things move around? So it starts with a transformation. The fairy godmother comes onto stage, and you see the beautiful show drop with the castle, and that goes out, and then the house starts moving in and everything, and then Cinderella appears. So it has this already fantastical beginning. And then as the scenes change, fairy godmother is always coming in to make that happen. And we also... And this was just because you want the audience to relate, and we do have a lot of young girls who come to the show. The long blue dress is very hard for a classical ballerina to dance in, for pirouettes and things like that.
Sure.
So we have a transformation scene in the ball where her long dress is magically becomes a short tutu with help of fairy godmother, of course.
Of course. And
fairy godmother is the one who sets the clock off on fire to stroke midnight. She's really the narrator of the show, and that might be something that people haven't seen before. In most productions, she doesn't really come in until Cinderella finds out she can't go to the ball.
Right.
So that's really fun. And the fairy godmother also has four seasonal fairies that come out with her, and all of her attendants, who are called the stars. So there's this sort of magical world, not just the fairy godmother, but this whole magical world. And then Cinderella has the birds and the baby mouse. So there's a real sense of fantasy in the show.
And are there stepsisters or villain in the show?
Well, I have to say that I play the stepmother. Especially at the Fox. And I'm, you know, over 6 feet and, you know, menacing, I'd like to say. But yes, there are two stepsisters and the stepmother who taunt and tease Cinderella and make her work constantly. And unfortunately, they rip the dress apart, too. So there's high drama at the ballet. But there's also some fun in the second act. The stepsisters get their opportunity because mother begs the prince for a dance. So, you know, he gets also a chance to be pushed and pulled around by the two before fairy godmother comes in and brings Cinderella in.
So let me just ask, obviously, if you're going to rip a dress, either it's made to be ripped, it can be ripped over and over again, or how? Can you give us that background?
The power of Velcro.
Okay.
So basically, I don't know, should I give the secret away?
Yes.
Well, basically what it is it's a dress on top of a dress.
Okay.
Your girls look like they're ripping the fabric, but they're actually taking the top dress off, and what's underneath is a tattered, ripped dress. So that's really how we created the illusion.
Oh, thank you for sharing that insight. Let's talk about the music. What music will our audience hear?
You know, this was, of course, the standard classical full-length Cinderella is Prokofiev, and we do use a bit of the Prokofiev, but there was also a Strauss version that was written. I think it was written, what Vicky said was that it was written as a contest, so they had like this contest to write a new classical version of Cinderella, and this was the version that won. So it's Strauss, so it's very waltz-esque. But for me, I thought the Prokofiev, because it's so angular in its chord structure and, you know, there's so much going on in it. I thought for the house scenes and for the sort of what I wanted is the pathos in the house, The Prokofiev had that a little bit more potently. Mm-hmm. So we hear the Prokofiev more when you're inside the house. And then when you're at the ball, you hear these big brass waltzes. And I mean, you feel like you're in Vienna.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Sharp. He's the director and choreographer in Cinderella on April 28th and 29th at the Fox Performing Arts Center, put on by Inland Pacific Ballet. Jonathan, tell me, what do you hear from children when you're either instructing in the little ones or throughout the ages? Why do they want to dance?
You know, I think it's just that people are born with different hypersensibilities. Some people are very visual. Some people are very physical. Some people are very audio, you know. And then, like for myself, I'm visual, audio, and physical. You know, I'm sort of hyper. And I think that that's what you see with kids who, like if you have a little kid who's twirling around or who just loves to run or whose body just enjoys that endorphin, that's really what picks them up and lifts them. To understand dance is really to give that physical life a language.
It's quite a dedication, you know, on the kid's part and sometimes on the parent's part, is it not?
Yes, and I mean, and it could be also a love of music. Like, people love music and they want to go and dance to it as well. One of the things we hear from the audience coming out, and it's so great to hear, is that the show is not overly long. So the first act is just under 40 minutes and the second act is probably the same. You know, you're in and out. So the kids don't have to sit a long time. But people will come out and say, my daughter did not move the whole time. And that's great. And actually, we also had one mother say, my husband didn't move either. So that was also quite good. So he must have enjoyed it as well.
So a show for all ages?
Oh, you know what? I mean, Cinderella is such a part of a sort of American folklore. It's one of our oldest, richest fairy tales, you know. And I think, you know, I mean, every little girl, of course, attaches herself to the Disney version. But what's great is I think that it sort of brings generations together. Like, you could see a grandmother sitting with her daughter, sitting with her daughter.
Right.
And they're all sitting there watching the magic of ballet and enjoying it together.
Is 5 too early to watch the show, or 5 years old?
I would have to ask the parents of that 5-year-old, like, how will they do? And maybe say, like, hey, it might be good to find a seat next to a door. But I think 5 years old, if the kid is used to being able to sit through something that's about half an hour long, I think they would love it. And again, it starts off with all this wonderful magic and transformation. So they're not having to read through listening to long strains of classical music if they don't have that focus. There's something going on stage all the time. And the characters mix and mingle. There's not really one section of the show, like, you know, Cinderella will have a solo, then the stepsisters will enter and do their scene. Every scene is about 2 minutes.
Ah.
So there's nothing that goes on. I mean, the pas de deux, which is the dance for Cinderella and the prince, is, I think, 5.5 minutes, maybe 6. So it's still, I mean, for a pas de deux, which would usually be 10 minutes, or, you know, I mean, it's still not a long stretch of classical music or ballet to digest.
Wow, it sounds like any audience would enjoy the performance, and any age might enjoy it as well.
Absolutely.
Very good. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, and I hope to see you at ballet.
That was Jonathan Sharp in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez. Again, Inland Pacific Ballet's production of Cinderella, Saturday and Sunday afternoons through April. Again, more information at ipballet.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Coming up April 28th at the California Theater in San Bernardino, Affordable Music Productions presents The Legends of Blue-Eyed Soul and Rock and Roll with Gary Puckett and the Union Gap and the Righteous Brothers. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. And up now, conversation with Gary Puckett, though we're not going into it with the music of the Union Gap. This is in anticipation of the concert with the Righteous Brothers. That's going to be April 28th here in San Bernardino. I did, however, find an Outcasts tune out there.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Yes, indeed. It's I Can't Get Through to You. So I might as well ask a little bit about that earliest of times first. There are a few different biographies, so I just need help sorting some of this stuff out. Were the Outcasts a band while in college or something after quitting college or maybe even the catalyst for quitting college? You had to have been around maybe 24 or so here.
Yeah, I think that I was. It was 65, 66 was the Outcasts, basically. We were working in a club. They're called the Quad Room, and it was after college. I had kind of already given up the idea of me going further in higher education and started working in the clubs, and this group was a real good group. I mean, we were just a trio. I played guitar and organ, and we had bass and drums, of course, and we were playing all the music of the day, you know, from the Beatles and the Stones to the Stax group of music, you know, stuff like Walking the Dog and, you know, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
Oh, yeah, nice.
It was popular of the day. It was a good band, but it wasn't destined to continue. So that's kind of that story.
Okay. You were born in 42, so was it in your teens when you started with guitar? It had to have been, I guess, Elvis and Ricky Nelson then at that point. Is that what made it happen?
Yeah, both of them, actually. Elvis was the big one. Ricky, of course, was a part of that whole thing. I used to watch Ozzy and Harriet. And, of course, you know, when Ricky was having his success, I was always waiting for the end of the program to see what his next hit record was going to be or what he was going to play. And actually, when I was six is when my folks started me on piano lessons, which I did not continue with after about a few years, but found a guitar in my grandparents' attic when I was about 15. And of course, you know, at that point in my life, I was hearing Elvis and Ricky and the Everlys, Coasters, Platters, you know, the list would kind of go on, Eddie Cochran,
sure,
Gene Vincent.
Nice.
So it took my thoughts away from the classical sort of beginnings that I had that my parents started me on, because I grew through that era that was from the sort of big band into rock and roll. How do you describe it? There was a program called the Hit Parade.
Sure,
you might remember that.
Yeah. Well, I'm a jazz geek, so yes.
Yeah, Julius LaRosa and, you know, the singers of the day, Patti Page, I suppose Doris Day, people like that, you know. But I remember that sort of in-between place, you know, where, how much is that doggy in the window? You know, silly music, but it's still, we loved it. You know, I loved that music. And then along came Elvis, of course, in about 1954 or 5. And that sent me off on the other track with Bill Haley and the Comets and the rest of the people I mentioned.
Oh, yes, indeed. Sort out then, please, Gary Puckett and the Remarkables going to the Union Gap featuring Gary Puckett. And now somewhere specifically, there's a cool story that I found about you guys conserving your energy so that you could give a harder drive when you thought Jerry Fuller would be in the audience, but he was there on the night of the more mellow delivery. Is there truth to this legend?
Yes, there absolutely is truth to that. I had found him, you know, he's given credit for discovering me, of course, and I don't mind that at all. But I had prepared a portfolio that I took to Jerry, ultimately, when I discovered him at his office, hanging up a gold record award for Travelin' Man, which he had written, of course.
Oh, there's Ricky.
So I asked him to look at the portfolio, and he did, and we got along famously, you know, in our meeting, and he asked me where he could see the band, so I told him that we were working at the Quad Room in San Diego in the Claremont Bowl. It was a bowling alley, 52 lanes, and he said, I like your voice. I like the idea of the outfits. He said, I'm going to come and see the band. I'll be there Saturday night. And as the singer in the band, I probably did 80% of the singing. And that's a lot of singing, you know, from 9 p.m. until 2 a.m. kind of thing. And the boys, you know, took some of that duty. But so I was kind of cruising through the night on Friday, you know, letting the other guys sing more and hoping to save my voice for the next night. And he showed up that night at midnight, and I was standing on the edge of the stage, and I kind of looked down at him, and he looked up at me, you know, and said, hey, let's go make a record. And I just went, wow, yeah, please, let's go make a record.
That was a conversation with Gary Puckett, who, along with the Righteous Brothers, will be in San Bernardino April 28th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming, thanking you so much for your support of public radio here in our region. So then it sounds like you guys were already the Union Gap. You were not the Remarkables anymore. Can you address for a second the name The Remarkables?
Well, you know, it was just a working title.
Okay.
It was something that I thought of, and I don't really have any story behind it other than I knew that it wasn't the name that the band was going to go by, but we needed to have a name. We needed to have a dress, you know, to look sharp on stage, and so I dressed the band in kind of double-breasted blue blazer jackets with white pinstriped, bell-bottomed, hip-hugging kind of trousers, and, you know, we were a nice-looking band, but it was, like I said, just a working title until I could think of what it was that I felt was going to help us make our inroad into the recording industry, and that was it. I said, we'll be the Remarkables until I can figure it out. So
were you then the Union Gap because you had the outfits, or did you get the outfits because you became the Union Gap?
Well, we got the outfits. It was sort of a simultaneous thing, actually. A little agent had come down to see us. He liked us. He thought that we were a decent band. And he says, I think I can put you to work in a few spots. So we were pretty excited about the possibilities of going on the road. Well, I learned real quickly that the road is really not much fun at all, particularly if you don't have hit records to support it and that kind of thing. We went to work in Van Nuys, California, and from there we went to Seattle, kind of my old stomping grounds because I grew up in Yakima Valley, basically, you know, from about age 6 until 16. But Seattle was a stop on this little mini tour, as it were, and I kept wondering what it was I could do to help propel the band, you know, to move us forward somehow. And I had learned along the way there that there were an awful lot of records that were being released to the radio stations between 400 and 500, as a matter of fact, you know, and we only had a top 40. So I had no idea how we were going to get a shot at that top 40. Because if you remember, which you do, the 45s only had a little black sleeve or a white sleeve or a gray, maybe red, you know. And I thought, we've got to have a visual image that's going to help us over that little hump right there, you know. And I had no idea how it was going to do that, but I just kind of thought that if I could get a picture on our first record, that it might be helpful. And in fact, that's exactly what occurred. By the time Jerry Fuller had decided that he wanted to record my voice and the band and all that kind of stuff, we had become the Union Gap. I did not put my name in front of it, but I kind of conceived the whole thing all at one time because I had the interest in the Civil War period in history, you know. And one day while we were working in Seattle, I just went, Civil War, yeah, I was born in the North, I would have been a Union soldier. And I went, Union soldier, yeah, we can all dress differently and the same, you know. And then, of course, having grown up in Yakima Valley, and I used to hitchhike to Union Gap when I was 15 years old to do my Saturday job, you know. So it was sort of simultaneous, Union soldier, Union Gap, I've got it, fellas, I know what we're going to do. You know, they thought it was a pretty stupid idea, but I said, well, it's what we're going to do. So tag along, you know. So I, on the way back, we went to a club in Portland called the Long Branch or Longhorn Saloon. I'm not really sure at this point, but it was kind of a topless club, and there was a section of it. It was a big, long club, and there was half of it was not topless. The other half was, you know.
Oh,
and
gotcha.
So there, we played on the dancing side of it. And then we went down to Vallejo, California. And from there, I took the guys to a place called Western Costume, which is where we found out that the outfits were very expensive to buy. So I rented one, and I took all the guys and went to Tijuana, Mexico.
Nice.
Yeah, and we found there were two things I knew that you could get down there that were actually quality, and one of those was upholstery, and the other was tailoring. You know, so
I found a little tailor
who could speak no English. Found a guy to translate, and he knew exactly what to do. So he made the first jackets for us, which were really superior, and we put the rest of the outfits together with, you know, Flag Brothers boots. I don't know how that name survives my memory, but, you know, put some braid on the pants and things like that, had some hats made and stuff. And
Our first outfits were terrific. So then I put a portfolio together of the band, and there was a little ghost town outside of San Diego, kind of like Knott's Berry Farm, where they had a jail and a saloon, and they had a cemetery, you know, with tombstones and stuff like that.
Right.
So we went out there and took a whole bunch of pictures, and I assembled a certain amount of them in this portfolio along with lyrics that I had written, and a demo of the other band that I had been in prior was called The Outcasts.
Right.
Took it, you know, to all the record companies. So finally found Jerry Fuller, and the rest is sort of history.
That is way cool. And the thing about the outfits, didn't you guys end up designating, one of you ended up being the sergeant, one of you ended up being the corporal? Was that something that stayed through and through?
Yeah, it stayed through the Union Gap life. And the only reason for that was that I just wanted the outfits to be a little bit different. So
sure.
We had different stripes and things of that nature. I was supposed to be the general. Of course, all I could find was second lieutenant bars. So I was really a second lieutenant. Yeah. But they called me the general. So,
beautiful.
You know, it was all good. It worked. One of the key factors of it all was the fact that I decided that the reason that I wanted this visual image was so that we could get through that idea that there was only a top 40 and that the 45s only had a nondescript black, white, gray, etc. sleeve, you know, and if we could get a picture on our first record, then somebody out there might look at that picture and think that it was pretty cool and might wonder what that record sounded like. And fortunately, our producer, Jerry Fuller, was a very, very talented producer. He was a song guy, and he had a song that he wanted to record, and he thought my voice was cast perfectly, you know, for that song. It's
was
called
that
Woman, Woman,
Woman,
and
Woman.
You Got Cheating on Your Mind. So the whole idea, though, that I wanted that picture on the 45 really panned out for us because there was a guy in Columbus, Ohio, who was a Civil War historian. And the picture, you've probably seen it online. It's very authentic. It was taken in the auditorium of a school that had been demolished by the wrecking ball. And it was very authentic looking in so much as we used sepia tone,
yeah,
the old brown tone,
kind
you know,
of thing,
and
yes.
The whole stage had been toppled down around us,
yes.
And it really looked like we might have been fighting a war, you know, and it was very casual. There might have been an inside joke that doesn't really matter, but it was fun, you know, and
yeah.
This guy, I can't remember his name now, it seems to me his name was Bob Harrington,
okay.
But he was, like I said, a Civil War historian, and he looked at it and went, cool picture, what's this record sound like? So he loved the record, he put it on as a pick, and it went to number one in Columbus. And the regional Columbia office was in Cleveland, which is, you know, hop, skip, and a jump. So they saw that number one. They called me in San Diego. They said, come on, we're bringing you guys to Cleveland. We're going to go promote this record because now that we have a number one, we know how to make it a worldwide hit. So that's what we did.
Yes, indeed.
And it happened.
I'm so glad. I didn't expect this. So I love the behind the scenes kind of things. But the fact is that the 45s especially, you know, we talk about how albums were better than CDs and the fact that you could look at the art and all that kind of thing. And that talks about the 45s. Most of them were very nondescript, the white or the gray or whatever.
Right.
And those
mm-hmm.
ones that had the pictures, those ones truly stood out. I've picked up some just because they had a picture. I had no idea who the guy was. So yes, and that really worked out. That is really cool. That was Gary Puckett, who along with the Righteous Brothers will be in San Bernardino April 28th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. We talked about Woman, Woman. This was the first huge hit. Now, it seems it happened almost right away, at least from my lens point, far removed from this. Or was it? I mean, CBS got you, the staff songwriters started writing, then we got Woman, Woman. That was Jim Glaser and Jimmy Payne.
Jim Glaser and Jim Payne, that's correct. A couple of boys from Nashville, Tennessee.
Ah, of course.
And, they had written the song, they had put it out as a group called Tom Paul and the Glaser Brothers. It was not a hit. I don't know to what degree it was successful, but I do know that both Jerry Fuller, our producer, And a guy that was very close friends with Jerry by the name of Glenn Campbell both knew the song, both wanted to record the song, and I had found Jerry right at the same time that they were both in that little sort of race to get that song recorded, and Jerry says, I got it, man. We're going to do this song if Glenn doesn't get to it first. So he went back to Columbia Records when he saw us there at the Quad Room and got the publishing papers, the recording contracts, all that together. And we went in, but it did not happen overnight. It was recorded August 17, it was released September 17, and it wasn't until Christmas that it started to happen, because as you remember, records then were released as an A and B side.
Yes.
And, you know, radio stations could choose basically what side they wanted to play. And this fella at, I think it was KCOL, he loved Woman Woman, and he played that one, but it wasn't until he did, because other stations were playing the B side, which was called Don't Make Promises You Can't Keep. It was a Tim Hardin song.
Yes.
And Tim was kind of a famous songwriter in the circles then, and it was a cool song, and we all loved the song, but it wasn't destined to be the hit, though some markets were playing Woman Woman, some were playing Don't Make Promises You Can't Keep, but they were working against each other, and it wasn't an overnight success until it started to become a success, and then it rapidly went up the charts. But Jerry had said to me at one point, he says, I think we're going to have to go in and record again and try again, because the A side is working against the B side, and we just don't see any movement either way. It's like they're both doing a little bit, but not enough, you know? So
right.
It was this guy, Harrington, in Columbus that took it over the top, so to speak, you know, because when Columbia saw that number one going on, they just went, hey, now we've got a foothold, so let's go. So that's when it happened.
That's your bullet right there.
Yep.
Speaking of Woman Woman, slight sidetrack, I found when I was researching, this may be an old Nashville Now or some television appearance, but you had an appearance with Jim Glazer, the co-writer with Woman Woman. This was a treat for those there, it was a treat for me, but more importantly, I'd have to say that it has you playing guitar and singing. So, you know, because often you were the front man on a mic with other people playing. So that was really cool. But how long at that point since you two had sung together or been around together for that tune or anything like that? Because the harmonies were right there.
You know, that was impromptu, really. I didn't know I was going to be on the show with Jim, but, you know, being on the show with him was a lot of fun. We had a really good time, but like I said, it was impromptu. There we were. He had written the song, so he had sung it many times, and certainly so did I. So we just sang it together, and it was fun.
It was really fun. It was a brief moment. You breezed through a number of tunes, doing those bar chords that I've never been able to tackle in 30 years.
I've always thought of myself as a great guitarist, but I'm not really. I just study a little bit every day and try to learn something new, you know. So I'm fortunate to work with three guys as my union gap that are just fabulous, very advanced musicians, and they all teach and they all, you know, write and they all play, and they've played all the different kinds of genres from country to jazz, you know. They pull me along a little bit.
Okay. Maybe when I love you, I know you're not satisfied. Cheating on your mind, on your mind.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talking about you as a guitarist, this skips a couple of things chronologically, but If the Day Would Come. So this is one of the tunes that you're credited with, and by the time that got to the studio, did you play guitar on this track? I'm sure you
were. I probably played acoustic. By the time we got to the third album, which was called Incredible,
that
included Lady Will Power and Over You, we as a band, the Union Gap, the original Union Gap, wrote most of the songs, and in fact, I think we wrote all of the songs. I did a lot of songwriting with Jerry Fuller, and If the Day Would Come was a song that I had initially written, and Terry Chater and Gary Witham jumped in and wrote the bridge part for it because they said, we think it needs a bridge part. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that I played acoustic guitar on that song.
The guys you just mentioned, they were with you when you were still the Remarkables, right?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Remarkables was the band that became the Union Gap. Yeah. It was Paul Wheatbread on drums, Dwight Bement. Dwight played all the instruments. He could play guitar, bass, he played sax, clarinet, even played some drums. And in fact, we used to have fun. Everybody would move to the left one instrument on one song during the night. And so I would switch over to bass and, you know, everybody else would do something else. It was kind of fun to do because not many bands could do that very thing.
That's right. So,
yeah, but Kerry Chater played bass and keyboards. Gary Witham played keyboards, sax, clarinet, etc., and I was able to play keyboard, guitar, and bass. So it was kind of a fun band.
Do you still do that these days? Jump over an instrument with the current lineup?
No, we haven't done that so much, but okay. I do sometimes play something on the piano, and
nice.
I am the guitar player in the band.
Oh, good.
Maybe we'll follow.
So this was a period, some of the ones that we glossed over were some of the biggest of hits, Young Girl, and of course, and we mentioned Lady Willpower and Over You. These contributed to, in 1968, you guys had so many gold records, and at this point, sold more records than any other recording act, including the Beatles, at this point in 68.
That's what I'm told by the history books, musical history books. I always say to the people, you know, I think the Beatles were just having a bad year. And I do remember, you know, they were going through their changes and the fight between Lennon and McCartney and the whole deal with Yoko and all that kind of stuff. But honestly, I think that it may have to do more with single record sales than album sales, because we did sell a ton of records that year, probably up around 20 million or something like that. So it's a nice little badge of honor to wear, being true or not. That's all I can say.
Okay, nice. Yeah, well, that's a great way to look at it. We mentioned those biggies, that several of the next big ones that we had mentioned, Young Girl and Lady Willpower, and these were credited with Jerry Fuller, but several, if not all of those, have your tunes on the B-sides. So I'm curious about the songwriting process and how that went when you were with CBS. If you would bring something to the table, Jerry would say, well, I would do it this way if I were you, or, you know, how did that kind of thing work for you guys?
Well, kind of like you say, you know, it's not like we were the Brill Building, and that's well known as a songwriting sort of factory in New York City, you know, and so many of the great writers back then were a part of the, hold on, young man, I'm not through yet, I'll be right with you.
That was the Lieber and Stoller.
Anyway, the Brill Building was well known for having people come into work, go into their office and sit down at the piano or the typewriter or both and do that sort of crank it out. And I don't mean crank, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
it was
more
like a, this is our job and this is what we're going to do. We did it differently somehow. Songwriting was something that, you know, it would come to me whenever it came to me, and I would write down whatever I wrote. I would put together whatever chordal structures and things, and then I'd say, hey, Jerry, what do you think of this one, you know? And so he would take it from there, and he would come back and say, okay, here we go, you know? And the same with the boys in the band, you know, if we wrote anything together, it wasn't really together, it was that we would take whatever the other guy had at the moment and then go expand and expound kind of thing.
Cool.
You know, so.
Okay. I'd like to address one that wasn't so big with you guys, but huge for others. Quinn the Eskimo, a Bob Dylan tune, but we probably most associated with Manfred Mann.
Right.
You guys put it out there maybe only a year or so after Manfred Mann, and so I'm really curious why so close. Is this just a CBS thing, jumping on others' popularity?
I guess you could call it that, jumping on others' popularity. The reason for it, okay, in Jerry's opinion, was that in making an album, he would like to have songs that were hits. He thought that me as a singer, if we already had fans, people would like to hear me sing Kiss Me Goodbye by Petula Clark, or The Mighty Quinn by Bob Dylan, or whatever other song that we chose to do. And generally it was a decision between the two of us. But when he said, let's do a Dylan song, you know, I'm sure all these years later that he probably thought, well, he'll choose Lay Lady Lay or something like that. And I said, no, let's do The Mighty Quinn. Oh, what a fun tune. We did those for the reason that Jerry thought that the fans would like to hear us do those songs. It wasn't just covering things. That was his philosophy, you know. And all these years later, I mean, I do The Mighty Quinn in my show now.
Oh, good.
And I didn't do it until just recently, ever, you know.
Wow.
So, but it's a lot of fun to go back and do those songs, because I was a fan just like everybody else, a fan of Petula's, a fan of Bob's, a fan of everybody else that we might have recorded, from Bee Gees, whoever.
That's really a nice way to put it. It sounds like more of a cross-promotion and introducing others to someone else's music, more than a, I guess I put it in kind of a negative way there with a popularity thing. That was music from Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, in conversation with Gary Puckett, who, along with the Righteous Brothers, will be in San Bernardino April 28th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming, thanking you so much for your support of public radio here in our region.
I dream of the magic to make you want me once again. A sorrowed man who sees loneliness in the years to come. So all alone without you.
I'd like to hear about A Simple Man. And my notes on this one is, this is another great example of the non-power ballad kind of thing. You know, Mighty Mighty Songs from Jerry Fuller, but they were that soaring power ballad. And A Simple Man, this was more of a Gary Puckett that I enjoyed hearing.
I get a lot of compliments on the song. I wrote that with my then brother-in-law, Eddie Colville is his name. He was just one of those gifted kind of musicians, gifted songwriter, I should say. We did a lot of songwriting together, and I think some of the things we wrote were really pretty brilliant, but never really saw the light of day other than to be on an album or the flip side or something like that. But Simple Man was one of those. It was an Eddie Colville lyric, and I related to it, and so I wrote the music to it.
By street lamps, cold wind blowing down the road. Too much wine has washed away the way back home. Beggar cries, Lord, I'm so lonely. And the darkness answers back with memories.
Just a few more things here. Another wonderful B-side. This is from around 1970, I think. The A-side, Let's Give Adam and Eve Another Chance. But the one that I really liked would be the flip side, The Beggar. And so, again, this is a tune. There is a version of this floating around on YouTube with you and Nancy Sinatra performing this, by the way.
No kidding. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
time passes and her beauty even greater. Not a child's eyes reflect the joys of life. And their home is filled with the warmth of love, while the world outside turns white with the winter snow.
Yeah, The Beggar is one that I started somehow, and I love that tune. I think it's unusual in so much as it's a little bit about tragedy, you know, and Eddie Colville was the writer of the lyric for the most part, I'm pretty sure. I love the song. It was one of the early recordings, actually. That's one that a lot of people have been mentioning, and I'm probably going to put it into the show at some point pretty soon because I really like its intent and purpose. Another one that just crossed my mind is No One Really Knows. I love that song. I just absolutely love it. I think it's a great, great song. And another song about loneliness, you know.
Yes.
And the beggar cries, Lord, I'm lonely. And the cold wind blows his dreams into the night. The cold wind blows his dreams into the night.
Well, before we wrap, I want to pretty much catapult into close to modern times, but we're still going to go back a little over 30 years or so with a comeback tour. I'm not sure who Thomas K. Arnold was. This ended up being one of those showcase tours. Was that the beginning of these in 1981 for you with this thing in Vegas with Thomas Arnold?
Well, Thomas, there was a point where he was kind of my manager, and he was a writer, a good writer, and we had a parting of the ways. So, no, Thomas wasn't involved with the multi-act tours. In 1984, I was on the very first Happy Together tour.
That's what I'm
thinking.
Which
was the first oldies tour to go out there. It was the Turtles, the Association, Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, and Spanky and our gang.
Mm.
And we went out there and we toured for 8 months of 1984, starting in, I think, in February. And it was something that was actually as much my idea as anybody's, but a promoter from New York City wanted to have a meeting with me one day after one of his employees had seen me in concert at a place called the Meadowlands, which I don't know what it's called anymore, but one of those great big sports venues on Long Island there, I believe.
Sure.
I said, okay, I'll meet. So we met, and he said, I'm working with the Association and the Turtles, and I'd like to work with you. And then at one point I said, well, I think you ought to put all three of us out there on tour. And they went, good idea. You know? So they added Spanky and our gang, and it became a very successful tour. They put one out in 85, and then in 86 it became the Monkees' 20-year reunion tour.
Yes.
Which I was also invited on, and it toured for 7 months, I think, of that year. And it was, in fact, the biggest tour of the year because the Monkees were once again, after 20 years, huge stars because MTV had been playing their reruns day and night.
Yes.
Nonstop,
yes.
You know. So all the mothers that grew up with the Monkees now had daughters who now were in love with the Monkees because they watched the reruns.
Yeah. Yep.
And we
yep.
were out there constantly. So it was another great tour. But that was kind of the beginnings of the multi-group tours.
When you said the mothers, that I for a split second thought that you were going to go to the Mothers of Invention. Where?
No. Well, actually, the Turtles had worked with
Papa right.
quite a bit.
Oh, yes.
All those years later. But no, that was not where I was going.
Okay. All right. Well, now today, before we wrap, the current band. Let's talk about who they are, how you gathered them. How'd this happen?
Gosh, it goes back years now. Woody Lingle is my bass player, vocalist, band leader, sort of advanced guy. He does a lot for the group, and he's been with me 15 years. And when we met, he had been recommended. I called him, and he said, listen, I just learned a ton of material for Ricky Van Shelton, I think it was. And he says, I've got to see this to its close. And I said, all right, well, let's stay in touch because you come highly recommended, and I feel like we've sort of connected on the phone, as it were, you know. So we stayed in touch, and there came a point where he joined the band, and that was about 15 years ago. I don't remember how long it was from the first time we talked. It could have been as much as a year or more. So he's been with me 15 years. The drummer has been with me about 9 or 10 now. And I met him through recommendation, just like I met Woody through recommendation. And years later, after having worked with the fella for, oh, I don't know, 9 or 10 years, he decided to go off and do orchestral things. Mm. He wanted to write and arrange for symphonies and things like that. So
nice.
Woody, my band leader, put the word out through the Musicians Union and different things like that. And a guy from Austin, Texas, called him up and said, I'd like to be the guy. So he flew into Nashville, where Woody was at the time, and they got together. Woody called me and said, I think this is the guy, you know. And it's not an easy chair that the keyboard guy does in my group, because he has 3 keyboards, he has 2 computers. We play it all. None of it is sequenced. These guys, like I say, are very advanced in their playing. And, you know, we're able to play anything, just absolutely anything. And I attribute that to them more than anything. But Jerry Fuller used to say about me that I could sing the phone book. So anyway, our music has mostly pop, sometimes a little country,
sure,
sometimes big band.
Nice. Now, with some concerts, there might have many groups on stage. In this case, for us, April 28th, it's just you and the Righteous Brothers. And so you've got plenty of stage time on a show like this one. So, of course, we're going to get Young Girl, Woman, Lady Willpower, all the big hits, of course. But what else? Can you bring in the beggar this soon? Or how about some of the other wonderful flip sides?
No, I can't. Unfortunately, we won't have the time to bring it in, because it takes us a little time. Woody lives in South Carolina. I'm in Florida. Jamie's in Texas. And Mike is in Las Vegas. It takes a little bit of doing to get it together that way. So, no, I won't be able to do the beggar. But we are going to do some of those other tunes that we've spoken about that I love to play, like Kiss Me Goodbye by Petula Clark, like To Love Somebody by the Bee Gees.
Oh,
which,
nice.
You know, these songs were on our albums. We recorded them. It's not like we're just playing anything at all.
Right.
You know, all the hits will be there. We do a little doo-wop kind of thing, because Johnny Maestro was a good friend of mine in the last couple years of his life. So we do a little thing that we put together, and I might do a little medley from the Happy Together 2013 tour. So it's fun. It's entertaining.
That's music from Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, in conversation with Gary Puckett, along with the Righteous Brothers at the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 28th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Gary Puckett, and more on this concert with Gary Puckett and the Union Gap and the Righteous Brothers at affordablemusicproductions.com. Thanks also to Jonathan Sharp with Inland Pacific Ballet, and again their production of Cinderella, Saturday and Sunday afternoons through April. More information at ipballet.org. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Isel Quapio, Emmanuel Rogers, and Jessica Greenwell. Beyond the music of Gary Puckett and Union Gap, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. And you can hear past KVC Arts programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. Thanks especially if you contributed during our spring membership campaign. We are truly listener-supported public radio. I'm David Fleming, so thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.